welcome to this week's episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM people-powered radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's episode is entitled Limited Resources. Talking this week about films that center on characters that are low on something, or perhaps even everything, at some point in their journey. So, or it's a general kind of exploration of cinematic depictions of scarcity, I suppose, scarcity as a concept. And it's certainly applicable, I think, you know, all of these, all the given contexts that are explored in the three films we're going to be talking about today, they all have sort of their specific characteristics and that sort of thing. I think we could draw on some broader, kind of more universal concepts in talking about things like scarcity and the idea of limited resources. Obviously, the big C word, capitalism, comes to mind, kind of in two senses, I suppose, because in one sense you can talk about it, you know, well, you know, what are we to do about, you know, this scarcity of resources that we have, things like fossil fuels and non-renewable energy and things like that, and also a perceived sense of having very little in an unequal system, or a system in which, you know, most of the stuff goes to the top and most people have a lot less than what they have at the very top. But then on the other side of things, you know, you could talk about how capitalism is very much predicated on the idea of efficiency and doing the most with the smallest amount, or doing the most it can possibly do with the smallest amount that it needs to use. You know, in the process of maximizing profits is all about minimizing cost and that sort of thing. So it's interesting that these films can kind of speak to both sides of the coin. I think when we talk about them specifically, we'll sort of see how these films kind of walk a very thin line in terms of what they actually say about living a life in which certain resources and certain valuable things are scarce, and what to do about that and how to appreciate those different things. So the films themselves that we're going to be talking about, we're going to start off with Charlie Chaplin's 1936 film Modern Times. And I can't believe this might be, I think this is the first Charlie Chaplin film we've done on the show in 2 years. And then we're going to move on to Agnes Varda's 1962 film Cleo from 5 to 7. And amazingly also, this is the first Agnes Varda film we've done on the show in 2 years, which is, I'm sorry about that. That's poor form. And then we're going to finish off with Wim Wenders' new film, Perfect Days. And we have done Wim Wenders' film before. We've done Paris, Texas, which is a personal favorite of mine. And I absolutely, just off the record, loved Perfect Days. 10 out of 10 movie in my books. But let's get started with Modern Times to kick things off this week. So in terms of just a brief synopsis of what happens in the film, we've got Chaplin playing his classic tramp character. So we're already starting off in a world of, you know, essentially a homeless guy living through the Depression with very little, you know, the classic look of the disheveled suit and the top hat and the little moustache. And the film kind of starts out with this, I know people often don't like the fusing the words Kafkaesque and Orwellian together because they mean they're different things, and it's kind of done to death sort of using them synonymously, but it is a bit of a mishmash where you have this kind of conveyor belt, little cog in the wheel factory that he works in the opening scene. But it is also Orwellian in the sense that this is like the boss is like this big brother who looks through like televised screens in 1936, which is really cool that they did that in the film and everything like that. But you know, you can see that the other people talk about that sort of thing. I've talked about the other thing before, and basically the tramp goes on this, you know, he has a nervous breakdown while working on the factory line, goes crazy from how monotonous and ridiculous it is, starts seeing screw and bolts everywhere, goes a bit crazy, and goes on this kind of whirlwind on this odyssey through all sorts of, all different places, meeting all sorts of different people, and kind of winds up in all sorts of different places. And so I want to talk about how this film explores, I guess you could call it, the idea of mobility despite scarcity, or having very little but going a long way, or ending up in all sorts of different places despite having very little means of doing so, limited means of doing so. So despite the fact that he has, you know, a lack of financial power, there is this motif of constant movement and sometimes accidental movement, which we're going to talk about in a little bit more detail in a second, but this constant motif of lots of movement. So we obviously get that in the plot in terms of all the scenes, you know, he moves along from the factory to protests. And then he goes to jail and he goes back to jail and da da da. And then also in each scene, and it is interesting that he likes going back to jail throughout the film. Just as a side note, I'm not going to go into this in too much detail, but in terms of a film that sort of subverts some ideas about scarcity and what it means to have scarcity, it's interesting to see that he has this kind of relationship with the jail where he doesn't feel imprisoned by it in terms of it. He feels actually quite empowered by it because there's a funny joke where he talks about how he actually likes being there because he's really happy there. So that's already lifting up this idea of scarcity being something that's somewhat a question of perception. We're going to see that sort of explored in every film we're going to talk about this week in different ways. But also each individual scene has a motif of constant movement. Obviously, being a silent or mostly silent film, there's a lot of movement in his character. But in the imagery, we see lots of things like conveyor belts and gears. And we have the famous shot of him going through the gear scene, a bit like Toy Story 2 with the airport conveyor belts. He goes through all the gears and he himself is within the gears, which is obviously symbolic of him being caught within the gears. But, you know, he is moving in around and out of these little tubes and funny things like that, sort of being thrown around. And of course, this is a kind of powerless kind of mobility, but there is sort of an internal contradiction there where he has got a lot of movement. There is a lot of mobility about what he's doing, despite not necessarily being in power. And that kind of brings us into this question of involuntary movement. So as I mentioned, he's getting pushed around by the cogs and the wheels and the boss and his colleagues and things like that. There's also really interesting moments where like his belt loop will get very like Chaplin and Buster Keaton-esque kind of thing, where like a person will be standing there and a car might come past or a cog or something slips by and catches like their belt loop or their sleeve or something like that, and they get yanked away and moved somewhere. Or there's scenes in which he's blindfolded and then there's like he's blindfolded by a flag and then gets mistaken for like a protest leader and that sort of thing. So it seems sort of getting swept up and moved around the world a lot. And sort of to sort of repeat what I said before, there is a sense that he's powerless in that movement, but he's moving nonetheless, and his fortunes do sort of change on a dime here and there. So it's not like a tragedy in that sense. There's tragic elements to it. There's a sort of a sweet sadness to all of Chaplin's films, but ultimately they are quite optimistic. There is almost like a Taoist kind of go with the flow in a Western world kind of vibe to it. And you could say you could take a really cynical view of the film and what I'm saying and say, well, that's just because, you know, in a silent film, there's not much you can do to keep people entertained. So things in constant, it's a bit like the TikTok generation. You've got to keep things moving. You've got to keep people entertained. It's got to be slapstick and funny and physical and that sort of thing. But that in and of itself, I think, still proves the point. The fact that, you know, it was a high budget film for its time, but the fact that Chaplin was able to do so much with so little, right? They didn't have CGI. They couldn't record that much dialogue, or at least in 1936, things were changing a little bit, but they couldn't do it the way that, think about watching it like Avengers versus this and how much more they can do now, and how this is still a very entertaining film. Even if you showed it to a child, they would still find this quite entertaining because he is so resource efficient. Chaplin, he himself also was the writer, director and star of the film. So it's like a very streamlined, for a film that is sort of critical of capitalism, it's a capitalist dream film in a way. Then he goes on to, anyway, I'll walk into that, but But even in any event, the name of the film and I think the general premise of the film also, this idea of mobility as a motif is also permeated in sort of the general premise of the film. You know, it being called Modern Times, and I think City Lights also goes into this a little bit as well. But we get a lot of, as I mentioned before, at the beginning of the film with the factory, we get a lot of big buildings, electricity, you know, motor cars zooming by and that sort of thing. We get a sense of things moving very quickly, society industrializing, particularly American society, a big metropolis like, and this film does have a sort of a Fritz Langian kind of metropolis-y kind of, even if I'm like, even a lot of, we talked about Kafka a couple of years ago, they're bulky stories, there's a lot going on, things are changing very quickly. And this is mid-depression. So it's almost like things are going along very quickly, despite the fact that the economy has slowed down. And if we really want to read into that more deeper, that could be because things are moving in a bad direction. But there is still movement. There is still mobility. And by the end of the film, without giving it away, even though we are going to give away the end of the film by the end of this episode, we do get a sense that there's enough inertia, enough momentum in 1936 for Charlie Chaplin to tell his audience that it's okay where you are right now, look at the world, look how fast it moves, look how quickly it industrializes, and look how quickly my fate can change on a dime. This too shall pass is sort of the, I guess you could say, the moral of the story. There's always something to look forward to. There's always a road to walk down and a direction to go in at some point. But what happens when our number does come in, let's say? What happens when, we do get a bit of good luck finally, and something good does fall into our lap, and our number comes in and we end up being quite fortunate? Does this sense of scarcity go away? Does the anxiety of not having enough go away when that happens? Well, before we move on to our second film for today, just remind you, while listening to Sacred Cinema here on 2XX98.3 FM, People Powered Radio, I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, here for the remainder of this half-hour slot. But stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX. And also be sure to jump onto our website to subscribe to the station if you're not there already. Consider sponsoring the show. That'd be very much appreciated. It's a pleasure to have you. And let's move on to our next film. So this would be Agnes Varda's 1962 film Cleo from 5 to 9. And in our opening scene, it's the only coloured scene of the film. We have this tarot reading, and Cleo, who's our protagonist, finds out that she is potentially, something bad's about to happen to her. She gets like the death card, but the clairvoyant's kind of like, oh, maybe it's not that bad. I don't know. Anyway, she's kind of in this sort of state of something bad's supposed to happen, but I'm not entirely sure if it is. And this kind of sense of limbo-ness of I've got a hunch that something bad's about to happen to me, but I'm not exactly sure when or how or why, is sort of cemented by the fact that she's also had bad test results, and she fears, and she's a bit of a hypochondriac and fears that she's going to have cancer and die very soon. Because of this thing. And then we follow her for an hour and a half, or in the movie universe, 2 hours, I suppose. And we watch her cope with the uncertainty of her fate. Maybe she is going to croak in a couple of months. She doesn't know at this point. And we sort of are with her through that sort of anxious period. And I want to talk about this being a film that I think really beautifully depicts how scarcity is kind of a constant, no matter what echelon you find yourself in, what position you find. So even if Charlie Chaplin wants to end up, in a great situation, a sense of scarcity seems to be as constant no matter what. So if we can be really simplistic to begin with, Cleo, I mean, to start off with, the name is Cleo. That's a reference to Cleopatra, and there's questions around her name, and she's just sort of we're going to get into this in a second, but she's a bit of like a split personality in terms of who she is at her core. But on a superficial level, her name is Cleo. Cleopatra, very beautiful person. She is very beautiful. She's a celebrity. She's rich. She's a singer. She lives in this culturally rich city like Paris in 1962. So on paper, we could say that she's lived a beautiful, luxurious and lavish lifestyle and should have no idea if to feel any sense of anxiety around any scarcities in her life. Yet throughout the film, she undeniably feels a sense of the finite creeping up on her, or her amounts, the amounts of things that she requires and what she needs, dropping. And that's, I guess that gives us a sense that scarcity of some description is always going to find a way into the picture, let's say. So like, no matter how luxurious your lifestyle might be, you're always going to feel a sense of disempowerment and not having enough on some level. We could look at it in a really cynical way, which is to say that, rich people always want more. They always want a second or another yacht. But I think this film is a lot more sophisticated than that. It's getting to sort of I think it sort of legitimizes in a lot of ways why someone might feel that way. And we could even say it's a very early depiction of something like intersectionality, where we can't simply just look at one aspect of an individual person and say, well, we can define how powerful they are just by them belonging to one specific class or group in society, i.e. Being, white, or being a man or a woman, or being, high socioeconomically. There's going to be multiple groups that someone falls into, and we sort of see the interplay between those different groups in different ways in the film. We're going to get into that a bit more in a couple of seconds. But in talking about how she does live this beautiful, luxurious lifestyle, we're in the world of extremes. And when we talk about things like archetypes and two-dimensional characters and even stereotypes in films, that can often be a way of sort of saying, focusing on a bookend and saying, if it happens to people at this end of the spectrum, well, it's definitely happening to everyone down the line. So the fact that she feels a sense of not having enough kind of implies that this is a universal experience, and that's part of the reason why she's the protagonist of the film. But she does actually lack a lot of things, which is the cause for her anxiety, right? The obvious one being time, given that there is this sort of precarious feeling of it's quite a morbid situation that she's in, that she's got a sense of that her mortality could be sucked up and, you know, taken away from her pretty soon. You know, the entire premise is not only a metaphor for, is not only a depiction of sort of the experience of someone with a potentially terminal illness and being a hypochondriac, but I think broader than that, it's a metaphor for the existential condition, being that we could all have our lives potentially cut off any minute. And no matter how rich you are, no matter where you found yourself in the world, you could be hit by a bus tomorrow. The world could end tomorrow. And there'll be no legacy, no record of you. It'll be like you never existed at some point in history. There is that big black death sort of facing us all, no matter if you're Bill Gates or whoever. There is sort of a sense of an existential dread that the death is creeping up on us and we never know when it's going to strike. And it's just that, you know, this is a more of an immediate thing. And I think we can say this about a lot of films about terminal illness, where they are sort of metaphorical of, or puts us in the position of, and I think apocalypse films can do this as well, they put us in the position of, well, what if we actually faced our mortality, is what those films are kind of about a lot of the time. Or we can, I think they serve that purpose really beautifully, because a lot of us don't think about death ever and we forget that it's actually coming. But there's more to this film than just simply being a metaphor for the existential condition and the fear of death and things coming in. There's an interesting kind of I think she's anxious about a kind of lack of competence or a lack of talent in her life as well, because we have the great music scenes where she's having to sing and she's talking about how she'll learn the music but she's not quite ready to do it, she doesn't want certain songs and that sort of thing. And it reminded me a little bit of I think that's actually, you know, for someone that doesn't read that many books, it was funny to that I think that there's, I did pick up on a couple of similar, and I know Agnes Varda hasn't spoken about being influenced by Jane Austen at all, but like there's such an, like, I felt that she is very similar to the protagonist in Northanger Abbey, who kind of is this sort of paranoid person who kind of makes a big mountain out of a molehill about things that aren't necessarily that big a deal. And there's a similar parallel, but I think more so also, if you think about Emma and that Emma archetype of, and I can't remember if we talked about Emma on the show, I can't remember, but that kind of Emma archetype of someone who sort of fits the mold and is quite beautiful and is quite privileged, but in a kind of five easy pieces kind of way, hasn't really done all the work they could to be the greatest person they possibly could be, and has a sort of insecurity around that. And it's kind of funny to think that they would be telling other people how to live their life. In this case, she doesn't tell other people how to live their life, but there is that kind of, it's a very distinct form of embarrassment where you have everything, but there are some glaring aspects of you, some glaring deficiencies in your skills, some glaring deficiencies in your competence that kind of make that beautiful figure, that beautiful image, that beautiful silhouette people perceive you as a little bit hollow. There's some, maybe some fractures or some little slits of deficiency sort of riddled throughout. So there's a kind of deficiency of talent despite having a lot. But we need to address sort of the elephant in the room here if we're talking about this film, I suppose, which is that it's clearly an early example of feminist cinema and feministic cinema. At least where the pains of her experience of being a woman at that time are quite suffocating. And the film was, I'm not the first to say this, kind of groundbreaking and being, you know, Varda was huge for the French New Wave and was a sort of, a breath of fresh air, ironically, for I'm sure a lot of women watching this film in 1962 to see sort of the first, some of the first films made through a female gaze. And we literally do get a literal female gaze where the camera kind of goes into a POV style and we see this kind of glaring man and a lot of sort of disgusting people in the street looking at her and sort of eyeing her up and down. And so there's a sense of being sort of suffocated by the grossness of her fellow man, specifically men, I suppose, in this film. And so we could say that in this case, kind of her sense of freedom or her sense of autonomy is in short supply. And I think this is true of kind of any kind of idolized figure, any kind of celebrity. They lose a lot of their privacy and a lot of sort of, they have very little control about where they can go. Think about Taylor Swift on her recent tour through Australia. She couldn't really go many places without people swarming her. And so that is sort of a perceived sense of scarcity, despite being, you know, the most powerful, influential person in the world. And it's funny talking about influence and things like this. Obviously, Varda was a huge influence on someone like Greta Gerwig. And I can't help but think of that speech, the America Ferrera speech from Barbie, and sort of talking about that, and the suffocating feeling of having to be this kind of flawless role model, always having to look beautiful, always having to be kind of perfect in the eye of the male gaze, and that is suffocating and takes away and makes people feel, make women feel, I suppose, that they don't have enough freedom, they don't have enough slack, they don't have enough room to move, let's say. And so what does Cleo do about all this? Because this is sort of where we sit for most part of the film, but eventually the film has the resolution. And I in short, because we're going to get into this in a little bit more in the next film, there is a sort of, I think, a push to embrace the present. But I don't want to go into that too much in case you haven't seen the film. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in a second, but there is this sort of embrace to, this sort of promotion of embracing the present. But that leaves us in a tricky situation, because in the case of modern times, we're talking about, you know, don't worry about so much about scarcity. It's not the end of the world, because we can always be picked up and dropped off somewhere else in the world. Even if it's not our own means, even if we are powerless, eventually we could be formed the right boat, go to the right island and find our people and go get rich and live a good life. But in Claire from 5 to 7, we've got this feeling that, you know, it's more actually about embracing the present. Don't be idealistic about the future being better and that sort of thing. Think more about where you are right now. Don't look too much into the future, because, you know, the more you do it, the more you think about getting more, that world is still going to be characterized by scarcity. You need to look at what you have right now, the beauty in the garden that surrounds you right now, and suck that in, and that's what will give you life. That's what will give you a sense of stability. So we've got an awkward contradiction here. Well, maybe that can be resolved with our third and final film this week, and that would be Mr. Wim Wenders' 2003 film Perfect Days. And to put briefly, we've got the protagonist is kind of like a toilet cleaner living in Tokyo, and there's a slight sort of complication at the end about what his lifestyle is like, but ostensibly this is a very sort of Japanese film, despite the fact that Wenders is not himself Japanese but has a strong connection with Japan. And this is the world of Marie Kondo and minimalism. And I don't want to say that this film is simply just a film that depicts the art of minimalism, even though it does. But I think further, deeper than that, it's a film that shows the power of this art. So the power of the art of minimalism. And I think in kind of derivative philosophical terms, what we could say is that it's very much a film that shows us how we can find the infinite in the finite, and the effect and the impact that can have on the individual. So we very clearly see the protagonist of the film finding a sense of inner peace and beauty in something that is traditionally repulsive, right? So he's a toilet cleaner, but the way that he scrubs it down and cleans it up and makes it better and does that sort of thing, it's depicted as an art. And it's interesting, you're talking about the different sort of lateral and linear worlds, where he has a co-worker that rates everything out of 10 every time he meets something or talks about something, he rates it out of 10, which is sort of so unartistic. And he's sort of the antithesis of our protagonist, who's very much about, you know, the inherent beauty of something. It's not about fitting it on a pedestal, putting it somewhere on a pedestal on a ladder. It's more about embracing it in its moment, in the present, and finding beauty in it, no matter what it is. And again, we're in the world of extremes, aren't we? Because you'd think that a toilet cleaner is kind of like, no offense to any toilet cleaners out there, this is someone that maybe want to be a toilet cleaner, let me tell you, right? The fact that that person can have such an enjoyable and artistic life sort of says that any of us could. And I got to say, look, a bit of a confession here. Sometimes when I talk about films on the show, I push maybe a little bit too much towards how I think we're supposed to respond to a film sometimes, even though I don't try to, or, you know, listening back sometimes I think that, or maybe sometimes I think about, you know, how someone could respond to this film. This film didn't do much for me, but it might do as well for someone else if they read it this way or look at it this way. This is absolutely how I responded to this film. I mean, absolutely honest. I felt such a sense of inner peace. I'm not saying I went home, looked up toilet cleaner jobs, but I so wanted to trade lives with this guy while watching this film. And that does sort of invite the question, you know, how does Wenders do this? And you could say, in sort of simplistic terms, it's a very clear, you know, very cleverly made film. He's a great filmmaker. And we've got very deliberate uses of music, which the 70s pop music, the pop rock stuff is very nice and calming, and it gets us in the zone. Very beautiful cinematography. The minimal dialogue is of this kind of ASMR-y kind of vibe. It was a very, like, just a nourishing film, just in terms of, you know, how your heart feels. A very peaceful soundscape. But I think one of the big weapons that Wendus uses is laying this story next to this concept of komorebi, which is a Japanese concept of it's sort of flashed up near the end of the film, so stay for the post-credit scene. But it's kind of the beauty of shimmering light through trees. And this is something that the protagonist constantly does, like as part of his day. And so it's kind of interwoven into his day. So it's kind of like it's always adjacent to it, it's always next to it. It's kind of interwoven and knitted into within the same fabric of his day-to-day life. So you kind of would sort of see these things as synonymous, his relationship with his work and his relationship with the light and the trees. And this Japanese concept of it's not just the shimmering light through the leaves, but it's the fact that there's this kind of snowflake element to it, which is like every shimmer is its own individual shimmer and will never be seen again. And so it very much encourages an appreciation of the finite, seeing beauty in the fact that something will never come again, that you just saw something that will never come again in the history of eternity, right? And so getting back to these kind of capitalistic ideas that we were talking about at the beginning of the film, it's interesting to read this film as whether it's sort of pro or anti-capitalism in a way, because on one hand, it's kind of this, you could cynically see it as a, not as a, depending on your persuasion, a propagandistic way of saying that, you know, even the most powerless guy can still be happy cleaning toilets and going to eat ramen and just chilling out and reading books and having a good time listening to tape decks, okay? You don't even need a phone to have a good life, okay? So stop complaining about not getting paid enough. But then on the other side, it's a reminder that we, you know, in reminding us that we can be happy with so little, it kind of goes against that kind of pathological growth mindset that capitalists are often accused of having. So it's kind of saying we don't need to keep pushing for more and more profits and surplus value because we already have enough. We can enjoy the little things that we have already. We don't need to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. So there's a very thin line here. And I briefly mentioned before that the character does have a slight complexity, the slight complication kind of near the end of the film. And I think that sort of depicts this idea that there is a kind of an inherent fragility to this kind of life. But if we can go back to this concept of komorebi, we perhaps see the reconciliation of this problem that we were talking about before between modern times and Claire from 5 to 9, where in one sense there is an inherent beauty in simplicity. Despite the fact that the things we appreciate are finite, we should actually appreciate their finiteness. And in doing that, the beauty in the simplicity of that is perhaps something that we should get around. We should appreciate finite things rather than maybe disposing of them. No matter how simplistic they are, right? How they're not particularly sophisticated things to stimulate us. But I think there's a way that we can actually sum all this up by just looking at the endings of all the films. So at the end of Modern Times, we see Chaplin and his girlfriend walking down a road together, right, to sort of talk about, the idea of being optimistic, looking forward. But then at the end of Cleo, we again see the protagonist and her specific love interest walking down a street together through in a beautiful garden. But just before the end, they stop and look at each other, almost to sort of say, it's not about moving forward, but stopping and embracing the moment. But then at the end of Perfect Days, we see the protagonist driving forward, which is sort of a mix of the two, isn't it? It's kind of like you're still moving forward, but you're doing so through an act of stillness. Like when you sit in the driver's seat, you're being still. So it was to say that no matter how limited or immobile we might feel, our lives are, our embrace of stillness can still be a profound way of moving forward. Thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of Sacred Cinema. That's all we've got time for this week, but stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio, and jump onto our website to consider sponsoring the show or subscribing to the station. We'll see you again next week. Thanks.